to create a civil society, a sense of community and personal awareness are required. But our human brain has this tendency to sort and group and categorize. And when it comes to doing this to other people, it's not really healthy for our democracy. We're exploring the complexity of living in a civil society this hour on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Two people who are looking at civility in a number of ways. George Goins is an author and educator who focuses on leadership and educational reform. He was Wisconsin Superintendent of Schools for 15 years, and he's author of Civility Lost: The Media, Politics, and Education. George, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks for having me.
And Carolyn Lukensmeyer is here as well. She's executive director for the National Institute for Civil Discourse that's based at University of Arizona, and her organization works to reduce political dysfunction and incivility. Carolyn, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Kate.
George, let's start with you. Take us to the Milwaukee airport, of all places, where you really have this aha moment because you describe recombobulation area going through security. How does that connect us to civility?
Well, the recombobulation area really brought a smile to my face as you go through the line to get to your gate. I flew into Milwaukee because my son is a police captain in Franklin, and I wanted to see my grandkids, and I had some work to do there. That term struck me funny at first, and then I thought what our nation needs is a kind of a recombobulation area, or at least an attitude towards recombobulating, getting our things back together and eliminating artificial divisions, eliminating people not speaking with each other, eliminating the uncivil discourse that occurs too frequently on social media, on television, and in our regular lives. And that's struck me, while humorous, also very important for our nation to do, because sometimes we are fragmenting into pieces rather than uniting into a whole to solve some of our problems.
So when did this start? How did this discombobulating of civil discourse all begin in your mind?
Well, in actuality, as a citizen of a democratic republic, there is always going to be discourse, and some of it's going to be discourse that is not everyone's not going to be unified all the time. And the expression of ideas is going to bring a disagreement. The expression of ideas is going to bring people to have conversations or face our disagreements and our different perspectives. And that's not negative. It's how you do it that's the important thing. We are all basically human beings with the same needs. We're not fragmented into different hyphenated categories. We're human beings with the same needs, living in a country that believes in active citizenry and active families and active communities. And the issue here is how can we, in contemporary times, with technology, with the communication on television and other ways, do it in a civil manner so that we don't fragment ourselves and turn each other into enemies? There's this attitude now that if you don't agree with me, you're an enemy rather than a rival on politics. And you can see that just in terms of what's happened in the last 2 weeks with Congress coming back together. Mm. So I think what's happened is there is always going to be disagreement in a democracy. The question is, how are you going to do it? And I think we've lost, in some respects, from our educational system and from our social media and our current society, how to disagree and learn about each other and our positions so that we can civilly address our problems.
And Carolyn, you run the National Institute for Civil Discourse. How would you rate America's level of civil discourse right now?
Well, Kate, there's no question but what it has been profoundly degraded in the really last 4 years. However, as George said, this began some time ago, and it's a result of structural problems in our electoral politics, too much money, gerrymandering, so many protected districts. So there's become a hyper-partisan, as George said. If you disagree with me, it's not that we're disagreeing and going to try to find a compromise. It's your enemy, and I feel you're my enemy, and I feel morally superior to you. But the place where, at the Institute, we really have a moment in time when we can say, for most Americans, this really became an issue, and it was the 2016 presidential election. And the choice of political rhetoric that continues to come, particularly from the White House, but from other sources as well, has continued to legitimate people's baser instincts. People, when we're doing community meetings, Kate, they actually say to us, well, if the president can do this, why can't I? So, you know, for almost certainly since World War II, we've been on a track of where the commitment in our community dialogue and in our political dialogue, and not that we haven't had conflicts before, certainly the Vietnam War, civil rights movement, but the arc of our conversation was to stay connected to one another enough to find a compromise to move the country forward. And that's what we've lost now. You know, Reber Shandrick does a survey of civility in America every year. And literally in 2018, the public, we, the American people, judged the incivility that we're experiencing to be a national crisis.
And Weber Shandwick is the public relations firm. Just
want to
get that in there. Carolyn Lukensmeyer is executive director for the National Institute for Civil Discourse. George Goins is author of Civility Lost, the Media, Politics, and Education. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you feel you've experienced incivility lately? Is it more or less than years past? And when you feel this way, what do you do about it? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. George, in the book, you include quotes from two former presidents, Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama, and the two men differed policy-wise, but you argue they both believe that the people of this country have a responsibility to its democracy. Help us through that.
Well, that occurs in a lot of conditions in politics, too. You not only have U.S. presidents agreeing about civility, but you also have two Supreme Court justices. You had Scalia, Justice Scalia, and Justice Ginsburg were great friends, and they were on, I don't know if a totally opposite, but certainly different perspectives on interpreting the Constitution and the law, and they became great friends. And Scalia, actually, there's kind of a funny story. When I was working on a book, I told one of my liberal friends that I'm going to quote Justice Scalia, and he said, well, I'm not going to buy the book. But Justice Scalia wrote a very good book for, actually, I think it's aimed at lawyers, in terms of how to make the case when you have a disagreement with someone. And he basically said that you have to build some sense of trust and fairly present the facts, and sometimes we don't always see the facts presented fairly, honestly characterize the issues, own up to what points of your position that may be a problem, and address them forthrightly and show respect for the intelligence of the person you're talking to. And I think Scalia's comments in this book are really getting at a case when you got two people with two different interpretations of the Constitution coming together and have a civil presentation to make a judgment on that.
And we have to pause right there. George Goins stays with us as our guide to this conversation. Carolyn Lukensmeyer as well. You can join in 800-642-1234 as we talk about civility here on the Ideas Network. Kids are keen observers of us. They process our words and actions. They watch us. And how we learn to be civil has a lot to do with our upbringing and education. We're parsing that. We're talking about how we can be more respectful in how we treat others and live with others in a democratic society here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're part of this conversation at 800-642-1234. Should we be stressing civility in schools, in the workplace? Do you teach your kids how to have respectful conversations? And have you made adjustments in your own actions in attempt to be more civil? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. George Goins is author of Civility Lost. He stays with us. Carolyn Lukensmeyer is here as well from the National Institute for Civil Discourse. That's at University of Arizona. And Carolyn, going back to you, do you see that people are able to overcome their desire to be right? Can we respect opinions that are in direct contrast to ours?
Well, Kate, that's a great question. And what we find at the Institute that's very, very hopeful is that most Americans really know how off track we are in terms of our inability to talk with one another across our differences. And they really want to do something about this. But our social structures and messages from leaders have been pushing people in the other direction. So what we find when we work in a community is if you create the safe space, a structure in which people who are very conservative, people who are very liberal, or often how they describe it is people who love the president, people who hate the president, they start out from a perspective of expecting hostility, expecting to have to be defensive. But if you create an environment where what they do is meet one another as people, so who am I? What in my life experience brought me to carry the political beliefs that I carry? When you set up that context, it takes time, but people very, without exception in our experience, move back toward the ability to stay in present contact and conversation with each other, respecting the difference, and frankly, learning things. Just this weekend, we actually had 12 millennial people together, young people together from the Midwest area. Several of them were from Wisconsin, and they ranged the entire ideology of politics. And when they came together, they expected to mostly be in conflict. Well, by the end of the time when they had an opportunity to really get to know each other, they were able to say things, you know, we're amazed at how much common ground we found. And although there's some things we're never going to agree on, I now really understand why you feel the way you feel about climate change or gun violence. So what we need to do, and we need to do it in every environment, in our homes, in our schools, in our workplaces, is once again set the norm, make it possible for people to take a deep breath, and instead of listening to attack back or to reply or to convince you that I'm right, listen for understanding and go back to that wonderful curiosity when you're young of, well, why do you think that way? What brought you to believe that? It's pretty exciting to watch.
Let's bring in a call now. Let's go to Georgia, joining us from Madison. Hi, Georgia.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I noticed, at least in my life, the explosion of incivility, and it's been an explosion. It happened when texting and social media became the norm. And I've had several instances where that has happened. I've picked up the phone with that person, sometimes a family member, had a conversation, and instantly there's a different tone. Like, hey, how you doing? And it kind of makes me think, in myself included, I remember going to a therapist years ago, and she encouraged me to write a letter to someone in my life that I just get everything off my chest that I would never send, but it would get it off my chest. And with texting and social media, we just get it off our chest and don't worry about the ramifications.
Georgia, thank you so much for those thoughts. George Goins, what do you make of that in terms of reading into our texts and our social media posts?
Well, 69% of the people in a KRC research study said that social media is part of the problem. And I agree with her about texting and the social media because it's very difficult. I have a granddaughter in college, and she texts me and I text her. That seems to be the norm for younger people today. And I always sometimes text back and say, can we have a telephone conversation because I'm not sure of the intention of your message. There's two parts to a message, the content and the intent. And sometimes that gets misinterpreted because you're not talking to the person and you can't clarify it. And that becomes a difficult way to communicate. The other aspect to that is it causes people on social media to end up into their intellectual silos. They're talking a lot to people they agree with, and sometimes in those conversations they demonize or enemify other people who disagree with them and build up barriers so that there cannot be a conversation with others. We even had a presidential candidate call a portion of the American electorate deplorables. And when you start stigmatizing people and not understanding other people's stories, I think then you build bridges, and sometimes, not bridges, you build walls, and sometimes the social media does build walls. And I think that's a problem we have to really consider, of getting to know the other people. I agree with Carolyn. Once you understand other people's stories and you have an opportunity to listen actively for the content and intent of their messages, you can maybe build bridges rather than simply, in a fit of anger, replying on social media to someone you may not know well, and you have no real understanding of their position philosophically or humanly, and you build those kinds of bridges. So I think the caller is correct.
Carolyn, though, social media is really also how we stay connected to one another. You know, a lot of the people on Facebook would be your family members, maybe a little bit of an extended family. How does social media impact civil discourse?
Well, I want to really applaud Georgia for the choice that she made to really pick up the phone and call the family member who had posted something on social media that was so incivil and negative. We find in the work, as I was describing before, Kate, that one of the biggest changes after people have kind of gone through this aha moment of how they've been in this silo and been really rejecting people with different political views, that one of the biggest changes is they change how they are writing on social media. And they do more picking up the phone to say, do you realize how angry you sound on that? So social media is an extraordinary plus in our lives in terms of being able to stay connected to a larger network of people. But it has also led to people being reactive in their communication rather than keeping the context of what impact do I really want to have on this person. What we work with at the Institute is, you know, in every other form of communication, radio, television, print, as each of them came to be dominant in society, standards were developed for what's acceptable in journalism, what's acceptable on television. And there's been great resistance to dealing with any development of standards on social media, and it's all been out of the perspective of freedom of expression. But I think if we just look comparatively of when each of those other mediums were the dominant way in which people got their news, the dominant way in which people communicated, we came to a place where we understood if we want to be a democracy where we can actually solve problems, we do have to be civil and respectful across our differences. So I think working for standards in social media is a very positive thing for people to commit to.
George, you look at public education and its impact on a democracy. In a couple minutes here we have left before the news break, what are the benefits to universal education standards?
Well, the benefits of universal standards are we have to really help students and others understand the basic values, beliefs, and principles that undergird our democracy. And a lot of times I think we focus on education from a single lens in terms of getting a job or employment, when education is really for life. And education in that sense means that you have to be an active person in your community. You have to be a person who is going to look at life from the broader view rather than simply as a job. And that means that you have to know how to interrelate with people and do your role as an active citizen. And in doing that, I think there are some very critical skills and techniques that people have to learn in school, not only critical thinking and complex thinking, but also skeptical thinking. And skepticism seems to have a bad name, but a skeptic will really ask people, newspapers, politicians, others, the question of, can you prove your point? And I think that's what has to happen in schools, is to learn to think critically and complexly and engage in a dialogue so that you can solve problems.
In an annual poll called Civility in America, it finds that we continue to perceive this severe civility debt in our country. 93% of Americans say civility is a problem in our society, with most classifying it as a major problem. We're talking with author George Goins and Carolyn Lukensmeyer from the National Institute for Civil Discourse. You have a voice in this conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you think you've experienced incivility lately? What does your church, your workplace, your school do to maintain civility? Let's talk about it. News is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Incivility and political scandals, they seem to win the day in the headlines. They often get more play than the substantive, meaty policies and proposals that lawmaker offices are working on. We're talking about civility and what politics has to do with it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Author George Goins writes that we must be aware that narrow political interests can be cancerous to the common good and feed incivility. His book is called Civility Lost, and he stays with us alongside Carolyn Lukensmeyer, who heads up the National Institute for Civil Discourse. You have a line, 800-642-1234. Do you think politics and the media play into the nation's civil discourse? Should we give some leeway for office holders in the realm of civility? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Jerry now, who is in Pittsville. Jerry, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I've been listening to this conversation for the last little bit as I drive down this nasty road here in 39 in Wisconsin. And I'd have to take exception with what I'm hearing, because I've heard it about 8 times so far, and that is that we are a democracy, and that in a democracy, you know, we need to outline what I perceived as certain constructs that allow us to have speech and expression that is unoffensive. And we're not a democracy. As a disabled veteran from Desert Storm, I took an oath that to uphold the Constitution. My understanding is that we are a constitutional republic. And when I hear the words democracy versus constitutional republic, in a democracy, you know, it's almost the adage that the masses rule, so the masses make.
So Jerry, tie this back though to a civil discourse and civility. Do you find that in your conversations with your family members and your coworkers, how do they go? Oh, he is gone there. George Goins, can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, I said we are a democratic republic, and the republic part of this is we're not a pure democracy. And being a democratic republic, we do have to have discourse, and some of the times the discourse is going to be at odds with each other. Citizens are not going to agree. The question in a democratic republic is, how do we learn to disagree civilly so that we can make progress, rather than just resort to what happens so frequently with name-calling, disparaging other people, and not listening to other people's discussions. The issue in a democratic republic is that you have to present the issues, and there are going to be people at odds with each other on what the best remedy may be to those issues. But then the issue is, how can we talk to each other, listen to each other, so that we can find pathways to bring people together to solve the problem?
Mm.
So we are not a pure democracy in that sense, where you just take a universal vote, take a look at the presidential elections. It's a democratic republic.
And so I think we have to find ways to solve those problems of disagreement in the Democratic Republic so that we can make progress. And too often it's just throwing verbal hand grenades at each other rather than sitting and seeking solutions.
Let's go to Troy now in Muskego. Troy, hi.
Hello, yes. Well, I actually think we're a lot of things. We take parts of socialism. We take parts of a lot of different things to make up this country. And one thing I want to point out is there's either a growth mindset or a fixed mindset. And I feel it comes down to how we raise our children. And what I mean by this is you raise your children to bow down and not stand up to injustices or authority, you know, just because somebody's got money or because someone's got power that you obey or you listen and you do all these things. But I was raised to stand, you know, to question authority, and not just because of someone's status that you stand up to them. So an example of that would be, like, let's say you're working at a job and your employer is totally, you know, abusing their powers and, you know, you're not happy. Well, I was raised, you know, you don't sit there and blame everybody else and demonize the scapegoat. Maybe organize a union. You know, and that's one of the great things about our country is that you will find out that you'll have good debate with people, whether they're Republican or Democrat, if they were raised to question authority and to challenge it. And I feel like people that are not raised that way, you end up getting these arguments with them where they get angry and they don't have answers, so they shut down. And then here's the conclusion I have is when people are raised not to challenge authority, you end up with they're subject to cults and they're subject to leaders that come along and provide those answers for them.
Troy, thanks so much for those thoughts. Let's go back to Carolyn. And what Troy was saying there, a growth mindset, a fixed mindset. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I think a really important part of his message was that there are real skills that are important for all of us to learn. And we do learn them in our families. We do learn them in schools. And so one of those skills is standing up for what's right. Another of those skills is learning to listen in order to really understand another person's perspective rather than listening to win the argument. One of the things, Kate, that I think your listeners might find very helpful is we've created a whole website, www.revivecivility.org, which has a whole lot of tools on how do you have a one-on-one conversation with a family member who your relationship has been fractured with because of politics. How do you organize a small group in a coffee house to talk about something like climate change? And do you want to have a community meeting to take on a divisive issue in your community? So the norms around civility and respect that have been really important to America's ability to progress as a nation, those norms have really been broken in a profound way in the last few years. And as the stats that you shared and I shared, Americans know this is a problem. And they know we have to step up to reestablish the norms of civility and respect so that we can disagree without demonizing each other. So we can disagree, but on a particular topic, whatever that topic happens to be, see if there isn't some area of common ground that can move our community forward. And so skills are really central to this.
And Carolyn, your organization, the National Institute for Civil Discourse, has a working group for members of Congress. What does that work look like?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I was just thinking that a lot of your listeners would probably be interested to hear that the Institute does a lot of work with elected officials, work at the state legislative level, and work in the House of Representatives. And frankly, many members of Congress and many state legislators and mayors and council members also are very concerned about this and also know that something has to shift if they're not just going to be stuck in their Republican-Democrat tribes and are actually going to get something done for the country. So how it looks is we have created a workshop called Building Trust Through Civil Discourse. And the workshop always includes the Democrats and Republicans in appropriate numbers, so there's real balance, occasionally a Libertarian, Independent, And we set up the conditions where they discover once again, you know, what drew me to public service. So the conversation is not first focused on, I'm a conservative Republican and you're a liberal Democrat, but it's focused on, who am I as a human being? What are the values I bring into this office? What are the things I really stand for? The core of Carolyn Lukensmeyer really believes, this is what drives my motivation to hold this position. And we discover the same thing with elected officials, Kate, that we do with the public, that once they really see one another as people in a broader context and have an understanding of their values and why they believe what they believe, it quickly shifts. They really do find common ground. We've worked pretty deeply in 18 states across the country. We haven't worked in Wisconsin, but we'd love to. And in all of those states where we've done this work, more bipartisan legislation has passed. More real collaboration between the two parties is becoming the norm again. In Congress, where the work goes after the workshop, is in specific committees. So committees where the majority chairman and the ranking member of the minority party agree. Maybe it's the Agriculture Committee. We know in a few years we'll have another farm bill. The farm bill impacts millions of Americans. How can we have the conversation about the conflicts that are built into the farm bill every cycle? How can we have those in, again, a way that leads to compromises that solve problems rather than demonizing each other because of our party affiliation? Is that helpful?
Yeah, and George, I want to bring you into here because sometimes compromise can be damaging and progress can be slow. And if politicians are always meeting in the middle, doesn't that hurt those in society who need bold change right now?
Well, I think your last caller raised an issue that I want to address a little bit that relates to this. Is that there are principles that you stand on. Being civil doesn't mean that you're a lemming. You're not a sheep following other people. But you actually can be the wolf howling in the wilderness based on standards and principles. And howling in the wilderness, does that mean that you deride people or diminish others? But that you stand on principle. If you take a look at the civil rights movement back in the 60s, people peacefully protested against inequality and injustice. And they did that in such a way that it brought the issue to the fore and people began to discuss it and think about it and made some dramatic changes during that period of time on that particular topic. And I think what has to happen is that we have to begin to take a look at the old aspect of the common good or the commons, where people emphasize that they led a shared life and they were connected by a common government, a common language, and a common history.
And I got to pause right there. George Goen stays with us. His book is Civility Lost, talking as well with Carolyn Lukensmeyer, who is along with us. She's executive director for the National Institute for Civil Discourse. Your thoughts are welcome, 800-642-1234. We'll be back here in a minute on the Ideas Network. Just tolerating incivility, saying that it's just a part of our world, is not the path forward. We're learning that withdrawing into our cocoons and into our echo chambers is not helping foster civil society. So where do we go from here? We're exploring civil discourse here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our guides in the conversation are author and educator George Goins, and the head of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, Carolyn Lukensmeyer. There's still time for your thoughts on how we can move forward and be more on the same page and what that page really looks like. 800-642-1234. Have you made a New Year's resolution that has to do in some way with civility? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, George, how much does our privilege, our color, our ability have to do with civility? Because we really haven't touched that issue of privilege.
Well, I think one thing that we have to do is I believe that we're not hyphenated, that we're simply human beings living in the United States, so we're American citizens. We hyphenate too many issues by calling them women's issues, minority issues, people, old age issues, rather than saying there are simple issues of justice, liberty, equality, or goodness, so that all of us can come together. As I was saying before, we are part of the commons, the common weal, the common good. And we have to understand that we are in this all together and that we are not divided artificially, that we are simply people who are facing similar problems, and we have to find ways to work together to do that. And unfortunately, that's not always the case. Even Arthur Schlesinger, the historian that was in the Kennedy White House, indicated that we have to take a look at more of the unum aspect of E Pluribus Unum than the pluribus aspect of it. And that means we have to come together as one entity, human beings who have issues in a democracy that have to address them and find ways to do that. And one of the major ways is being able to understand other stories and to listen to them and enter into a civil dialogue. And that's what brings people to understanding the common good and that we're all connected.
But Carolyn, is civility always the answer? What about people in, say, the LGBT community? Is it fair to tell them to be civil when they're fighting to keep their job and an employer could legally fire them for being gay?
Well, I'm really glad that we're talking about this because there is no doubt that civility is not the answer in every situation. And it's also, there's no doubt that in even a very difficult situation, I can protest, I can stand up for my rights, and I can make a choice on a continuum of how I do that in terms of civility and respect. At the Institute, the place that we experienced really pressure about what you're talking about, Kate, was when the family separation policy began to be administered on the southern border. And there was a sense of moral outrage from literally millions of Americans around seeing children in metal cages. And at that point, there were just tons of opinion op-ed pieces in newspapers and pundits on radio and television talking about civility is not the answer. What we found, and our home organization is the University of Arizona, so we really do experience the intensity of these border issues. But what we found when people were able to really be given an avenue to express their moral outrage, they themselves found that it was more effective when, in fact, it was done out of the position of influence rather than just out of the position of attack. But definitely, when people's rights are being infringed on, there is the most important thing to do is stand up for what you know is your civil rights. And there's a range of a way to do that that includes protest, but it can be protest that also stands on the principles of civility and respect.
And Carolyn, oftentimes it's the press who are reporting on those infringements on liberties, and your institute was formed after the shooting in Tucson that killed six people, wounded Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. So when we're looking at the media, are there clear answers to how we should be maintaining journalistic integrity and informing the public without reducing civility?
That's, as you well understand, very complex because just like earlier we talked about, most Americans really know that social media and texting have become platforms which make it easier for people to be incivil with one another and disrespectful with one another. The public also, in the same surveys that both of us have referred to, very, very clearly see the media as oftentimes actually supporting the incivility or making the incivility have the larger headline or have the larger portion of the program. So at the Institute, in fact, we're on a journey right now with the National Press Club to, in March, hold a conference here in Washington, D.C., that will be somewhat above 100 members of the media, all four mediums, and members of Congress and their staff, in which they talk with one another directly about, you know, the goal of the Fourth Estate is to hold elected officials accountable. But how has the Fourth Estate crossed the line in terms of also responding to things in a tribal way? And clearly the elected officials will have to be held accountable for whether or not they're taking sufficient actions to even deal with the safety of journalists, not only in this country but around the world. So this interface between media and politicians is one of the key places that we have to create a safe space for people to sit down, really share their concerns about what's happened, about how civility is covered in the media, how it sometimes is incivility is fostered, but also for the climate that journalists are working in currently about whether they really do have sufficient access to deal with elected officials who are dominantly shifting to a Twitter mode in many cases to communicate, which in fact makes it much more difficult for the media to do its job.
George, I'm going to have you jump in here, but in this recent Fox News op-ed, you laid out some civility New Year's resolutions, and I'm wondering if you could reflect a little bit on those and what advice you have for us who want to be more civil.
Well, actually, I wrote the commentary because of the civility issue that is imminent in our society today, and it's not going to be the government that's going to solve this. It's going to be how each of us as individuals relate to everybody that we meet each day and that we work with. And it's going to come down to our resolving, making a resolution that we are going to be better in terms of acting in a civil manner in civil discourse. And that basically means that resolving to listen actively to others so that you can comprehend their positions, make distinctions, and this is where it couples into the news media, between truth, opinions, hearsay, and beliefs. And frequently, we see a lot on social media and even in the press that doesn't make a distinction between what is true and what is opinion. And also to learn how to disagree and find common ground. And the basic thing here is to be more respectful of others, listen to the content and intent of their messages, build bridges and learn about their stories, because opinions that they have are probably formulated out of their background, their families, their experiences. And if we understand those kinds of things of others, we can at least make connections and have some understanding of where other people are coming from. And also to commit to the fact that we have to treat people with a sense of humanity in terms of what they are facing. And some people face very difficult things, and we have to build greater understanding.
And George, I want to leave it right there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And Carolyn, thank you so much for your insights as well.
Well, thank you for having me, Kate.
George Goins is author and educator, focuses on leadership and educational reform. His book is Civility Lost, The Media, Politics, and Education. And Carolyn Lukensmeyer, executive director for the National Institute for Civil Discourse at the University of Arizona. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.